some aspects or some main moral traits of moral indications and moral traits of the hypocrites are indicated. In one of them is simply that the hypocrites say something, but they seldom believe in what they say, or they don't believe in what they say. Yes, apparently they say that okay, they are Muslims, but in fact they are still non-Muslim, they are still a polytheist, or simply a non-Muslim. Another one is that hypocrites pretend to be helpers of Muslims, but in fact they try to harm the Muslim community and the Islamic religion and each and every Muslim they interact with. The effect of this is that apparently they come to help you, but in fact they make more problems for you. Let me give you an example. For example, your car may have a problem for which you may go to a mechanic in order to repair your car. If the mechanic pretends to be a good mechanic and pretends that okay, he knows how to do his job in order to fix your car, in order to help you, and in order to remove any shortcoming with your car, but at the same time you find that okay, he or she may have done something, but he or she has created many more problems for your car. Then you understand that this person cannot be a faithful person, cannot be relied on. And you understand that he pretended to be a good mechanic and to be able to fix your car, but in fact, he hasn't done his job properly. You find that, okay, this is an instance of hypocrisy. Or, for example, someone may pretend to be able to teach a subject in a class, okay, for a community, but in fact, he doesn't know the right basis or fundamentals of that subject. So long as he pretends to be an expert in that field, he's a hypocrite.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
The Holy Quran says in this way, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَقِيلَ لَهُمْ تَعَالَوْ قَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أَوْ ادْفَعُوا قالوا لو نعلم قتالا لاتبعناكم هم للكفر يومئذ أقرب منهم للإيمان يقولون غفايا ما ليس في قلوبهم والله أعلم ما يكتمون. This is indicated in the Surah Al Imran, verse 167. The gist of this Quranic verse is that when it's said to them that okay, come and join the defenders of the Muslim community, come and join the defenders of the community in order to fight in the cause of Allah or to prevent more harms, to reach the Muslim community, they would say, had we known any kind of defense or the way how to defend the Muslim community, we would have certainly joined you. The Holy Quran continues it and says, هُمْ لِلْكُفْرِ يَوْمَئِذٍ أَقْرَبُ مِنْهُمْ لِلْإِيمَانِ. In such cases, they are closer to disbelief, not believing in the Islamic religion, than to believing in the Islamic religion. يَقُولُونَ بِأَفْوَاهِهِمْ مَا لَيْسَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ. They say what they don't believe. Okay, in the heart, in the mind, okay, they believe in something else, but apparently they pretend to be someone different, to be a totally different person. وَاللَّهُ أَعْلَمُ مَا يَكْتُمُونَ. Certainly Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows better whatever they try to hide. Another indication in this connection is that وإذا بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وإذا قيل لهم تعالوا إلى ما أنزل الله وإلى الرسول رأيت المنافقين يصدون عنك صدودا. When it's said to them, come to whatever Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed, and come to the Prophet Muhammad, to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, you find that, you see that, you consider that the hypocrites try not to admit your invitation. Okay, not only do they don't believe in the Islamic religion, but they wouldn't make any attempt, any effort in order to come closer to you. So we find that, the hypocrites, hypocrites are such people who not only don't believe in the right cause, they don't make any effort in order to get closer to the believers' community. Another Quranic verse in this regard is in this way. إِنَّ الْمُنَافِقِينَ يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهَ وَهُوَ خَادِعُهُمْ وَإِذَا قَامُوا إِلَى الصَّلَاةِ قَامُوا كُسَالَى يُرَاءُونَ النَّاسَ وَلَا يَذْكُرُونَ اللَّهَ إِلَّا قَلِيلًا. Certainly the hypocrites try to play trick on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They try to cheat Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But in fact Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows better how to cheat them. وَإِذَا قَامُوا إِلَى الصَّلَاةِ قَامُوا كُسَالَى. When they are invited to perform salat, they are not that much inspired. يُرَاءُونَ النَّاسِ وَلَا يَذْكُرُونَ اللَّهَ إِلَّا قَلِيلًا. They do something, but not for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They want just to pretend to other Muslims, to other people, that they are believers. Quite explicit with the Holy Quran in the Surah At-Tawbah, verse 67, indicated it in this way. الْمُنَافِقُونَ وَالْمُنَافِقَاتِ بَعْضُهُمْ مِنْ بَعْضِ يَأْمُرُونَ بِالْمُنْكَرِ وَيَنْهَوْنَ عَنِ الْمَعْرُوفِ. The hypocrites, male and female hypocrites, some of them teach others. And this is the characteristic. They invite people to do vices and they prevent people from doing good. We hope to be away from being hypocrites. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi aman Allah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahalili and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program we discuss problems, issues and other relevant questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are based upon the holy book of the Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today we will again be discussing the obstacles we may face when we are raising our children, obstacles that prevent us from becoming outstanding and even good parents, and how we can identify these obstacles, understand them, and how to solve them. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم الآن أعدائهم أجمعين. One of the obstacles that we face as parents is that sometimes we give our kids what I call an electric shock. You know when a person goes into when he loses consciousness and he's about to go into a cardiac arrest or what have you, they give him that shock, that electric shock, and his entire body just jumps up. Sometimes we do a lot of this to our kids when in fact they are not aware of it. Okay, so to give you an example of how this works, a parent, a father or mother trying to sleep and their son or their daughter, they had the TV on and loud. So the father and the mother, they are so angry and frustrated. What they do is they come so angry, they unplug the TV altogether.
Right?
They don't say put it down. They unplug the TV altogether. And they start screaming in their faces, "What's wrong with you? Don't you understand? I'm trying to sleep. I was working." And the poor child's like,
You
know, you could have dealt with, so this is an electric shock to the child, to the system. You could have dealt with this manner and in an easy way. I understand you're angry, you're frustrated. But he's a child, and we have to make sure that we maintain this relationship all the time. There are many ways I could have came in a way where I could ask him to change that. I'm like, "My love, darling, I'm trying to sleep. Could you please turn the volume down?" That's something more acceptable, more nice, more something they can understand and work with, rather than just coming and screaming at them. And so as a parent, you need to be sure that when this happens, that you're going to cause a lot of stress and a lot of problems for your child, and we want to do the opposite. And this kind of electric shock happens pretty much all day long.
Right. And with that, dear Sayyid, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upping. Today we are discussing how to solve the obstacles we are facing when we are raising our children and on our way to become outstanding and excellent parents. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
So we said this kind of actions constantly happens where we do this to our kids, where we give them this electric shock throughout the day. And sometimes we don't understand, we don't even ask ourselves, would this actually work? Would this method work? Would this method give benefits and give fruits? Will the kids even will listen to me? Because I'm trying to educate here. Or am I just trying to take revenge?
Because I think with this electric shock that you're giving, it's just an outlet for your anger.
Yeah, so you're just taking revenge on them, basically. Sometimes, for example, when a kid does something, unexpected. For example, a toddler, he would I don't know, a spilled drink or something on the carpet.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the mother just goes berserk, right? I mean, he's a child. He's a toddler. He doesn't know much. He doesn't know any better to begin with, right? So if so what if he puts, you know, destroys, for example, tea or coffee on a white carpet? That leaves a stain. It's a bloody carpet.
Right.
It's just a carpet. It's not. Nothing is going to happen. You throw the carpet away, wash it, or what have you.
What's more precious, this child's feelings or this carpet?
Exactly. So what happened is we end up giving this child a scream and a yell, and I don't know, God, inshallah, without hitting. But then again, that kind of, you know, the child, he's like, all of a sudden, he doesn't know what's going on, and he gets that electric shock to his body. So and why is this happening here? Well, right?
This terror here is actually scared.
So it creates a sense
of jump scare.
It creates a sense of panic in them.
Right.
Where it's not required. And then obviously that will play a huge role on the child's life as he grows old, traumatized. So how much of these do we do a day? How much of these do we do a week? How much of these do we do a year? Right? So as a parent, imagine yourself constantly holding these two electric shock pads,
right?
And you're just walking around with them.
These defibrillators.
Yeah, right. So you're constantly walking around with them. It's like, okay, who needs it today?
All right, I'm ready.
I'm ready to shock someone.
Right.
And usually these kids go, you know, you keep zapping them every couple of minutes.
Right. Small misstep that they do. Right.
Yeah, and we do understand that it has a lot of negative side effects. It leaves a lot of negative side effects in the mind of the child. Okay, so instead we can you know, do, if they do something wrong, we can do it in a nicer way that makes maybe even have a lasting effects. Okay, if I'm trying to sleep, for example, and my kids are just have the TV loud, I would come sit next to them for 2 minutes. I say, okay, it's like, what are you guys watching? Is it interesting? Is it nice? And you know, have a conversation, get involved, right? And I say, I'm not interested. You guys keep watching. But just do me a favor. Could you just please put it down and just try to sleep?
Just do it in so many different ways other than shouting.
Yeah, so first you showed interest. Right. Two, you spent some time with your kids. Three, you made them understand nicely you're going to sleep. I'm like, okay, we better put it down. Dad wants to sleep or mom wants to sleep.
There's so many solutions. Yeah, so you can sit, you know, explain to them the situation softly, like your dad is very tired, he just came back from it. At the very least, instead of just shouting, and as you very eloquently put it, giving them an electric shock.
Yeah, so we can do it in a lot of way that at least we can have a long-lasting solution that the child, next time he himself understands that, okay, dad and mom are sleeping, I better put it down.
Right.
I, you know, sometimes I teach my kids to use headphones if they want to do something their own.
So many solutions.
Yeah, so many solutions.
Yeah.
Rather than just me screaming at them, right?
Right.
So I hear it loud in my son's PC is playing a game. I'm like, Habibi, I'm trying to sleep. Could you please use headphones? Like, okay, dad. And he just hit his headphones.
Solved.
Problem solved. Or say, ay, turn that damn thing off.
Right.
And then I leave a stain on his brain.
Right, right. And with that, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, he who has a child must treat him in a childish manner.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the problems and obstacles we face when we are raising our children and how to solve them. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
Now, instead of using electric shock with our kids, right? First, there are a few things we need to do with them to make them understand instead of just give them that shock. First, we come to the child and we explain kindly the problem to the problem that we're facing with them, or what's going on with them. So, for example, we explain to them, like, okay, as a father, I come, I see the toys all over the place. Instead of me yelling, it's like, clean your room. I'm like, okay, Habib, you know what? These toys could, someone could trip over them, you could hurt yourself.
You know, it's messy, kind of this. So I explain to them what the problem is. So they understand that there's a problem and requires a solution, and this is the solution. Okay? And then they put that into practice. And instead of just yelling at them, screaming at them, and just getting them to, I don't know, go crazy.
Right.
So
yeah.
So this is one method, a better method, instead of giving them a shock.
Right.
And then when it comes to convincing a child, okay? So you need to convince him that the action that he's doing is not correct. And you can come to the child in many ways.
Right.
Like I said, you can give reasons to why this action should not be done, why is it better this action not be done, and so on and so forth. So you explain to the child and you make him understand. You know, get this information to him in a way where it sinks in his brain that this is not a right action.
Right.
Or I can just come and scream and
treat him like an animal that doesn't understand
and
yell comprehend.
At him, like you said, and make it a big problem.
Right.
So there are a lot of things that we need to consider. Also, we need to consider the child's emotions. Okay. Now, we spoke about the emotion of the child in many, many episodes and how important it is and how it leaves a stain on the child.
Right.
So when you scream at a child, you kind of break his personality. You break his identity. It's an attack on his identity. So you don't want to do that. The more you do of this, the more you keep destroying that child. The more the child feels that he does not belong in this kind of environment, that he wants to go elsewhere, right? He says, okay, you know what? My house is not for me. I would rather be with my friends. I would rather be outside. I would rather be in school. I would rather be with my teacher. I would rather be with anyone but my house.
Right.
Why? Because he feels that every time he's in the house, he's constantly being attacked.
It's a war zone. It's not a safe zone.
Yeah, it's a war zone. So
right.
As a parent, before you give your children this shock, you have to remember that you are destroying their feelings and their emotions, which it's a duty that you need to maintain, not destroy.
Right.
So because you get angry, because you get stressed, which is normal, you try to control yourself and deal with the matter calmly and gently. So this is also an obstacle that we need to get over.
And with that, dear listeners, we end today's program. Dear Sayyid, I thank you for your time and for your insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If the dear listeners have any questions or other relevant comments and feedback, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our website, parstoday.com. Alternatively, you can also find us on the various social media accounts we have on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Communicate. We had a break for 5 months, but the Iran nuclear talks have now resumed in Vienna. What makes these talks so significant is because since August, Iran has a new government under President Raisi. In the media, in the Western media, they said that Iran has elected a hardliner. Iran is refusing to come to the negotiating table. Well, here they are. So Iran has sent a delegation to Vienna for the 7th round of nuclear talks. But now, of course, we have the usual lies and usual propaganda that accompany these talks in the mainstream media. And conveniently, right as the negotiation started, Israel says that Iran is at 90% enrichment. Even the director general of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, had to come out and say that this is simply untrue. Now, the Israelis even called up the Americans and told them to straight up drop the negotiations altogether. The handful of media stenographers in Vienna reporting on these talks repeat the usual Western narrative. They had scoops that weren't really scoops, but just attempts to sow discord amid the parties. They also amplified these talking points that Iran is being unreasonable in its demands, or Iran is too hardline and its positions are not flexible. The question is, why should they be? Iran's position is very clear. It wants sanctions to be lifted and for the United States to return to the deal that they signed together in 2015. So yes, in a sense, Iran is not being flexible. And why should it? The JCPOA is still in place, the agreement is still there, and so are all the parties to the deal. Iran, Russia, China, the UK, France, Germany, and the EU. The only one who isn't is the United States. Now I'm standing in front of the Palais Courbet where the talks are taking place. This is in the first district in Vienna, which is also home to a slew of luxury hotels such as the Intercontinental, the Marriott, the Hilton, the Ritz-Carlton, and so on. And each delegation has been staying holed up at a different hotel in Vienna's city center, with the Europeans and others acting as intermediaries between the U.S. and Iran, who are not meeting directly, shuttling messages back and forth. Iran has submitted two draft proposals this week, one about sanctions relief and the other about its nuclear commitments, with a third on the way. Dr. Baghari is the lead negotiator with the Iranian delegation. And like his predecessor, he also asked Professor Marandi, who teaches at the University of Tehran, to accompany him as an advisor. Professor Marandi was here in 2015 when the JCPOA was originally signed. He has extensive knowledge of the subject. And to get the side that is seldom shown in the media, I sat down with him for an exclusive interview to discuss the nuclear negotiations. He told me that during this past week, Iran had been issued a veiled threat. The Europeans had also refused to discuss sanctions removal and told Iran instead to just halt its nuclear program. He also told me that Iran came into these talks with a completely different, fresh mindset, and that the current administration was no longer hedging all its bets on the success of these talks, now that Iran is exploring other avenues and finds itself in a much stronger position than in 2015. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. It's a great honor and pleasure for me. Professor, how are you doing?
Very good. Thank you very much.
So, Professor, I wanted to begin by asking you, you accompanied the delegation in 2015 when they forged the nuclear deal, and now again in 2021. What are some of the biggest differences, besides the obvious ones that the Americans are no longer in the deal, but what are some of the things that have stayed the same and some of the things that have changed dramatically?
The difference between 2015 and 2021, I think that there are a number of key differences. One is that in 2015, there was an element of change in Iranian society that I think had a huge impact on how Iran was dealing with the United States and how Iran was to deal with the Europeans. And that was that many Iranians believed that if we had an agreement with the United States or with the Europeans, that our problems would be solved and that we could live happily ever after. So I think that's the number one issue, that a wave of optimism was created among ordinary Iranians. Not everyone, obviously, but a large segment of Iranian society felt that we could strike a deal, and the Americans would abide by the deal, and all would be fine. I think many politicians felt that way. I think the president, Mr. Rouhani, felt that way. And I think that heavily impacted, sadly, the way we negotiated as well. So we went into the nuclear negotiations at a time when the president was saying that my top priority is a deal. And that's not how you negotiate. You don't say that. It's like saying, I just want to sell the house. If you just want to sell the house, then the price goes down very quickly. he was saying that, you know, we don't have money, we have problems, my top priority is a deal. And that caused, I think, a major problem for Iran at the negotiating table, and that was felt, in my opinion. The first thing that one of the European delegates said to the Iranians, I think in Lausanne, was, since you have so many economic problems, why do you need a nuclear program?
Now, an article published by Reuters over the weekend quoted a U.S. official as saying that Iran continues to accelerate its nuclear program in provocative ways. And this point is something that's been repeated a lot in the media, but especially in the past days, this notion that Iran must be brought back into compliance, as if, you know, Iran is refusing to abide by the agreement. Once again, this is false, and this is a bogus talking point. When the United States left the deal in May 2018, Iran continued to abide fully by the agreement for a year. When the U.S. still refused to come back and also began imposing sanctions on Iran, targeting its oil and banking sectors and committing other acts of aggression, that is when Iran pulled away from its commitments in part. The thing is, Iran has the right to do that. It's literally part of the nuclear deal. Article 26 and 36 of the JCPOA are very clear on this. Article 36 stipulates that if one side isn't holding up its end of the deal, and that, quote, the complaining participant, meaning Iran, deems the issue to constitute significant non-performance, then that participant could treat the unresolved issue as grounds to cease performing its commitments under this JCPOA in whole or in part. So when Iran pulled away from its commitments, for example, enriching uranium past 3.67%, increasing the number of centrifuges and so on, these were all done within the confinements, within the framework of the JCPOA. So to call that breaking the agreement is simply untrue.
Do you feel Iran is in a stronger position now than it was in 2015, back when the nuclear deal was being negotiated?
So Trump came and tore up the deal and forced the Iranians to stare at reality in the face, you know, to take a look at the situation. The deal wasn't going well, but now it was over, basically. The Iranians then did a smart thing. Of course, there are differing views about this. And that is that some thought that the Iranians should immediately leave the deal, and some Iranians thought that leaving the deal was not a smart thing to do, and that it would be best to stay in for a while to show the international community that Trump is the problem and it's not Iran. That was effective. I personally think that Iran shouldn't. And then after a year, the Iranians began to decrease their commitments to the deal. So for a full year after the Americans left, and after the Europeans effectively left, because the Europeans also began violating all the different elements of the deal. They pretended or they nagged about Trump's policies and this is terrible or we disagree, but they did everything he said.
But they'll say that Raisi is a hardliner, and they say that the position the Iranian team is taking is hardline. What does that mean exactly?
It basically means that Mr. Raisi is saying, look, we have a 2015 deal, and you have to abide by that deal. And they're saying, you know, why should we abide by it? No, we can't abide. We have to keep some of the sanctions. We've approved these sanctions, so we have to. A lot of these sanctions have nothing to do with the nuclear program. They're about your missile technology. They're about your regional policies, your regional alliances. They're about human rights, your human rights violations, and global warming. You know, maybe tomorrow will be added to them. It was all a part of the, you know, but. We all know, everyone knows, the Iranians know, the Europeans know, that this was all a part of the maximum pressure campaign. They were just changing labels, using different labels to bring Iran to its knees. That was the objective under Trump, and that continues to be the objective. These well-mannered men in suits who are negotiating with the Iranians at the Coburg Palace, they're all trying to strangle ordinary Iranians. That's who they are. That's their the makeup of their personalities. They're not decent people. But the Iranians negotiate with them because for a host of reasons. One, as I said, President Raisi wants to have a deal. All Iranians want the problem to be solved. But even if we were to assume that they are not going to accept our rights within the framework of a deal that they signed, we still want to show it to the public, to the Iranian public, to the international community, that look, they won't give up these maximum pressure campaigns, this maximum pressure campaign. This is not Trump. This is not that nasty orange man. This is the, you know, well-mannered men in suits and who care about human rights and all that, you know, nonsense.
In terms of the sanctions that you just mentioned, this is a very important point regarding the labels that the Americans have given them, right? They say that these sanctions are because of Iran's malign activities in the region. They love using this term. And as you said, some of them are non-nuclear.
Let's imagine that we get back into the deal. Let's say we both, well, we are in the deal. They come back in and they start. Okay, so then after the day after tomorrow, let's say they remove the so-called nuclear-related sanctions and they keep all the other sanctions because we're bad people. And then they start imposing new sanctions again in the name of human rights and animal rights and global warming and I don't know, whatever, missile technology and regional alliances. And it's obvious that's what they're going to do. So, and this, by the way, is a violation of the nuclear deal itself, because the nuclear deal says that the United States must no longer impede Iran, the normalization of Iranian trade. In fact, they must facilitate it. The U.S., the Europeans, they must facilitate the normalization of Iranian trade and business and so on. So all of these are in violation anyway. Even if they change the labels, it doesn't make a difference. But the point is that the Europeans, even today, they're looking to keep those sanctions. And this is where the problem lies today, during the last few days. What the Europeans want to negotiate with Iran, what was the real sticking point? Why were the Europeans so unhappy about the Iranian draft documents? Because the Europeans want one thing, and they want Iran to stop its nuclear program. They're not willing to discuss removing the sanctions. They want Iran to stop because they want Iran not to have leverage so that they can keep the sanctions. That's the whole point. The whole point is to make people suffer and take away whatever leverage Iran has so that they can keep people suffering. So don't imagine that today they were talking about sanctions. They were saying, stop your nuclear program. And forget the fact that Iran's nuclear program is within the framework of international law. Forget the fact that these countries, some of them have nuclear weapons, except for Germany, they all do. Forget the fact that the Israelis have nuclear weapons. Forget all of that. Today, what they were stressing was, you have to stop your nuclear program. You have to end the accumulation of enriched uranium. But the Iranians know the only reason why they're sitting at the negotiating table with us is because Iran has leverage. So what they did in 2015 was they took away Iran's leverage, and then they started, they removed some of the sanctions in name, and they removed some other sanctions, and then they began to reimpose sanctions. For example, they promised verbally to not reimpose the Iran Sanctions Act. They did. They passed it, and all that. It's a very sad story, but the point is that the Europeans today, what they want is exactly what they wanted before. They wanted Iran to not to have leverage, so they couldn't argue anymore. They couldn't have forced the Europeans to make and the Americans to make a move. And the Iranians won't accept that anymore. And they don't understand this. Even now they're thinking, well, this is just for show. The Iranians are going to back down. let's push. You know, they'll be reasonable. You know, meaning they'll see the light, that we'll make them suffer so much. We'll make Iran. We'll threaten. They threatened Iran, and then a couple of times, and then they had to back off.
Just generally speaking, in what domain did they threaten Iran, militarily or economically?
Yeah, they threatened to make people suffer more, let's say. They also sort of implied that the mad dog may do something. The mad dog in our region may do something nasty, sort of like how a thug behaves, you know, a mafia boss or godfather, you know. Bad things can happen, that sort of thing.
Professor, you mentioned that Europeans think Iran is going beyond the original deal. At least that's what they're alleging. But how do they reconcile that, the Europeans, the Americans? Because they've been talking about things that weren't in the deal either. You know, Iran's ballistic missile program, Iran's support for resistance movements in the region. I mean, aren't they essentially trying to forge a second nuclear deal by demanding these things?
Yes, it's extraordinary that going beyond the original deal means imposing maximum pressure on women and children, trying to kill people. Because that is what they're trying to do. That's what these gentlemen in the palace are trying to do. That's what the American delegation that's hiding somewhere in the building next door, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make people and then they talk about Iran going beyond the deal. No, Iran's not stupid, because the Iranians know that if they give their leverage, they will continue to make people suffer. That's because they want to weaken Iran. They want to break Iran.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
When I spoke to Professor Marandi, who's advising the Iranian delegation, I asked him about the attempts of the Israelis to derail the negotiations. During the Obama administration, before there was any JCPOA, Israel assassinated several Iranian nuclear scientists. It then worked with the United States on a computer virus called Stuxnet to sabotage the centrifuges located at Iran's Natanz nuclear facility. Now, under both Trump and Biden, Israel has continued with this behavior, proceeding to attack numerous other nuclear-related sites, either through the use of cyber weapons or conventional explosives, in what Iran has called acts of nuclear terrorism and sabotage. Now, Israel has always strongly opposed any nuclear agreement or JCPOA with Iran, and this round of talks was no different. It's a rhetorical question, but what do you make of the Israelis' role in all this, what they're trying to do?
You see the whole of the whole Western media basically more or less the same. There was a poll carried out. I didn't read it, but most Americans think that Iran possesses nuclear weapons, and most Americans think that the Israeli regime, the apartheid regime, doesn't. But the Israeli regime has huge influence, and I mean the very fact that they can subjugate Palestinians, like the South African government did in the 1970s and 60s and 80s, and no one will complain about it. You know, they can bomb Syria on a regular basis, they can kill Palestinian kids on a regular basis, and you won't see it in the New York Times or anything like that, or CNN. It shows how much power they wield, how much power they have. So Western governments at the negotiating table, the Israeli regime's requests or demands were the impact could be seen at the negotiating table. Let me put it that way. But you know, it's interesting. If the Israeli regime is so strong and so mighty, why is it so scared It's always screaming that, you know, we're under existential threat. The reality is that it's a weak regime. It's a regime that's being propped up by Europeans and Americans for, I don't want to go into that. I don't want to. But, you know, it's being, the apartheid regime is being propped up by them, and if it wasn't for them, it would collapse. The United States and the Europeans, their stranglehold on Iranian women and children will gradually loosen, and I'm not saying tomorrow or next month or next year, but I think that this global trend and the global changes are weakening the Western Empire, and they fail to grasp the amount of change that's taken place. They fail to grasp the existential crisis that the empire is facing.
You said the Iranian delegation is ready to stay and continue. How come the Europeans and other parties went home for consultations? What does that mean exactly?
First of all, the myth-making that we see on the internet, that the Europeans told the Iranians to go back and, you know, speak to their bosses and bring a good, that's all of that is nonsense. Or, for example, someone said that, you know, the negotiating, the chief, he doesn't understand the magnitude of, you know, what's, again, this Orientalist mindset is if, like, we're children and we don't understand what, you know, what this is all about, and some lady in the United States, you know, she gets it, but our chief that sort of racism and hierarchy,
yeah,
that exists among liberals. Just, I mean, if Black Lives Matter and whatever's left of it is for their own country, it's not for the rest of the world. No, I mean, black, brown lives don't matter anywhere. That's why they strangle us. That's why they don't care. That's why the media won't say anything about the bombings of Syria or the strangulation of Gaza that takes place 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or the strangulation of Syria. They pretend that the sanctions are about human rights, but they are intended to violate human rights, whether it's Syria or Cuba or Iran or wherever. It's monstrous, but, you know, we've grown accustomed to it. But yes, he will be back. He will be offering them a way out. But if they think that Iran is going to go back and then capitulate their sovereignty and their rights, they're very foolish.
As the seventh round of nuclear talks in Vienna have concluded, all the parties have gone home for the weekend for consultations and debriefing before they return next week to continue the talks. A former French diplomat, Gérard Arrault, commented on the nuclear talks, saying that even if the JCPOA was restored, no Western company would dare invest a cent in Iran. No Western bank would finance any deal in Iran with the threat of the return of U.S. sanctions in 2025. Once was enough, the Iranians know it. Indeed, he's right. And this is precisely why Iran is asking for real, substantive guarantees from the United States and its partners. Who can trust that the Americans won't violate the deal again? Iran has more leverage now than it did in 2015, and not just in the domain of nuclear energy, but in all other domains. And although sanctions are akin to siege warfare and hurt people, Iran has still managed to stay afloat and circumvent them in some ways, despite the maximum pressure campaign that has crippled Iran. Iran is looking elsewhere for its benefit, but it isn't getting its hopes up, and has certainly learned from the past, choosing to look eastwards, forge closer relationships with its neighbors, and explore other avenues. Whether the talks in Vienna succeed is something no one can predict. One thing, however, is certain. Iran no longer has all its eggs in one basket. Coming to you straight from the nuclear talks in Vienna, thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is for a better life. For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akberi. We are discussing the importance of patience in this life. Inshallah, you will stay tuned and will listen. We are going to discuss patience according to the Holy Quran and according to Hadith prophetic traditions. Respected brothers and sisters, having patience comes with many benefits and rewards. Of course, patience is the capacity to endure hardship, difficulties, challenges, and adversities in our life. There's no doubt as to the fact that we face difficulties in our life. There's no one in this world who may not face difficulties in his life. What makes those difficulties easier for us is patience. So patience is definitely an admirable quality which helps us connect with Allah and endure the difficulties with the strength and with forbearance. So sometimes patience translates literally as endurance, although it's more accurate, you know, it's more correct to say that patience is perseverance, patience is persistence, and it depends from time to time and from occasion to occasion. Of course, in different contexts, there will be a change, a slight change in the meaning of patience. Anyhow, patience, whatever the meaning, makes up one of the two parts of faith. It is a part of faith, and it is a sign of tawakkul. It is a sign of trusting Allah and consigning your matters to Allah. So it is one part, one of the two parts of faith. What is the other part? The other part is shukr, which means thankfulness and gratitude. The importance of patience is a recurring theme in the Noble Quran with the word sabr. I think we have discussed it in the previous episodes as well, that the word sabr is a word that has been repeatedly mentioned in the Quran. It is appearing more than 100 times in the scriptures, in the text of the Quran. Now, patience in Islam is not about adopting, you know, a passive attitude. The Quran does not teach us to remain silent. Neither does it encourage confrontation. So, life is indeed a combination of challenges, with everyone having the freedom to do as they wish and live the life they see fit, you know. No one is denied the liberty to act. Everybody has the liberty and the freedom to act. So man is a volitional creature. He is a creature with free will. And sometimes you act in a way which angers other people. Sometimes you act in a way which causes hardship for other people, causing other people angry. So, to give you an example, you speak loudly, sometimes you laugh, sometimes you play outside other people's homes, sometimes you know, do a lot of things. This, of course, means that there will be times when another person's freedom is not compatible with our own. You act in a way which hurts other people. Let's have a break. We will be back.
Changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Welcome to your program For a Better Life. We are discussing patience. Allah Almighty has the power to take that freedom away. No, but man does not have the right and the permission to do this. And this is not something that any human has, and this must be respected, the right of other people to act and to have the liberty to act. should be respected. But anyhow, here comes the role of patience. When others are acting in a way which angers, which makes you, you know, run out of patience, here we need to understand that showing patience in the face of challenges and the face of difficulties and hardships can be very much rewarding, and managing patience to face difficulties and hardship successfully is as something that is highly regarded, has highly recommended. Being patient and exercising patience brings us tremendous reward in the eyes of Allah, and it earns us patience. إِنَّهُ مَنْ يَتَّقِي وَيَصْبِرْ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُذِيعُ أَجْرَ الْمُحْسَنِينَ. You can look at chapter Yusuf, verse 90. Indeed, he who fears Allah and is patient, then indeed Allah does not allow to be lost the reward of those who do good. And of course, we have many, many narrations and traditions from the infallibles, from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, and it has been reported from the Commander of Faithful, peace be upon him, that he said, "As-sabru an yahtamil ar-rajulu ma yanubuhu wa yakdhim ma yaghdhibuhu." He says in Ghurar al-Hakam, volume 2, and the hadith number is 1874. He says, "Sabr is to be patient for a man against what hurts him, wa yakdhim ma yaghdhibuhu, and to swallow what angers him, to suppress what angers him." Whatever pain and difficulties come, sabr is there, and sabr means to tolerate those difficulties and to suppress our anger. You know, all the infallibles, if you look at their lives, all the infallibles adopted this same attitude. They were patient. To follow the Prophet, to adopt the same values of the Prophets, means adopting the culture of patience and avoiding confrontation where possible. There is beauty in all of Allah's almighty creations, and we must see the positive more than the negative. Dear brothers and sisters, we can adopt the teachings of the noble Quran into our way of life in many ways, guiding us now and into the hereafter. We should understand that part of patience is the discovery of truth, which is why patience in Islam is not simply sitting away in the corner and allowing the world to pass you by. Life presents many challenges, and unfortunately there remains those who face many more challenges than the average person, and those that suffer from poverty, crisis and war, they face the biggest challenges of all. And of course, some are thankful to Allah, some are grateful to Allah, some are patient and some are not patient. Those who are patient in the face of those challenges and difficulties, they will earn the reward. They will definitely earn the reward, and they will be rewarded by Allah in the afterworld. So let's be patient, and Allah is with those who are patient. Inna Allah ma'a as-sabirin. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every cloud. Hand in us, every sparkling tear on every eyelash in us, every thought I have and every word I share.
This is IRIB English Radio.